Well, good morning. Now, let's give another round of applause for the band. And also thanks to Wes for sharing about what the Lord is doing in Honduras. I also kind of start with some questions. How many of you were here the last couple weeks or think you might have been? Yeah, for those who either, are not sure if you were here or you weren't here, as Dan said, we're doing a series, Bridges and Barriers. What are the barriers that might prevent us from sharing the gospel? And conversely, what are the barriers that might prevent people, especially here in the Bay Area, from hearing about Jesus, about from receiving the gospel? A couple weeks ago, Paco talked about one of those barriers, and that's awkwardness. How many of you remember Paco's? Anybody here, you want to talk about Jesus, but this could be an awkward conversation. We're not supposed to talk about politics or religion, but this could get... So that can be a barrier. The other one that Paul Taylor talked about last week. Sometimes we don't have answers to all the questions that people are going to ask us, and that can make us... That can be a barrier. Oh, no, they're going to start asking me about evolution or the Trinity or something, and I won't... And so that can be a barrier. How many of you filled out this questionnaire survey thing a month or so ago? Asking. One of the things that came up was this idea that many folks here apparently feel no urgency or very little urgency about sharing the gospel. That there appears to be no rush. I'll get around to it someday. You know, eternity's far off. Today's a sunny day. You know, I know I should share the gospel, but, I'm going to delay that for some other time. How many of you, how many, just out of curiosity, how many people, I know I should feel a lot of urgency, but the reality is my urgency. Okay, then I'll give another talk on lying at some some other time. Now, I guess, kind of start off with, you might kind of just sum it up in your own memories, a time when you did feel some level of urgency. When was there something that happened in your life that you felt there needed to be kind of a swift response? This is a significant need. I need to kind of respond. Maybe it was something that what I call of an emergency nature. There's a fire. Some of the guys are in combat situations that I talk with. There was a medical emergency. Or possibly there was something that felt like an emergency and you felt urgency, but later you look back and laughed about it. Everybody's looking at me blankly. For example, sharing the kind of first service, I remembered a story that my mother told me about when she was a young girl, and she was getting ready for bed, brushing her teeth in the bathroom. And her sister, my Aunt Jackie, went in and hid underneath my mother's bed. And there she proceeded to lick her own hand, covering it with large amounts of spit. My mother then walked into the bedroom, not knowing that her sister was hiding under the bed. And as she's about to climb into her bed, my Aunt Jackie reaches out with a spit-covered hand and grabs my mother's ankle. My mother felt some degree of urgency to suddenly be going to bed, and then all of a sudden you're grabbed. She screams her brains out, tries to jump through the ceiling. Her sister, of course, thought it was the greatest practical joke that had ever happened. And my mother said, years... afterwards, she did laugh about it, but she said also for years afterwards, she would take a running leap to get to get into bed every night. Also, it kind of reminded me, because I get off on these. How many of you are linear thinkers? It's kind of like, I'm much more kind of free association, so you have to kind of hang with me a little bit. When I was about 12 years old, I was down in Mexico looking at some beautiful tide pools, and I'm wandering kind of along in the tide pools, and I look down, there's an octopus. And, it's, 12, 18 inches across, the thing. But as a 12-year-old boy, this I now consider a dumb thought occurred to me to catch the octopus. So I kind of creep up on it there in the tide pool and reach down and grab it by its octopus head, pick it up, you know, triumph, I've caught the octopus, at which point it flipped its tentacles up my arm, and I suddenly realized that the octopus had caught me. And I said, being the brave boy that I was, I just started screaming and swinging my arm around. The octopus, flies off, splashes in the tide pool. But that was a moment when I felt some degree of urgency as suddenly you realize an octopus is holding onto your arm. Now, you know, both the examples that I gave, both of my mom and the spit-covered hand and the octopus, those were kind of urgent needs that had to do, in my case, with me, and with my mother's case, with her. We typically respond with urgency to our own needs. If we're in need, we tend to respond pretty quickly. However, when it's someone else's need, if somebody else is in significant need, the reality is we may or may not respond with a sense of urgency. Okay. I want to look into that a little bit this morning by looking at, I would call it probably the second most famous of Jesus' parables. I'd say, in my view, number one is the prodigal son, but number two is the Good Samaritan. And this is a story about somebody in urgent need, desperate need, a couple people don't feel any urgency and don't get involved, and one guy does feel urgency and does get involved. And then we're going to do a little analysis of why is it that some people don't get involved and some people do get involved. Now the context, it's in Luke 10. One of the lawyers comes up, the experts in the law of Moses, and says to Jesus, you know, what do I need to do to inherit eternal life? Now, that might mean, what do I need to do in order to go to heaven? And Jesus says, hey, you know, what do you think? And the guy goes, well, love God, love your neighbor. And Jesus says, that's right, now go and do that. Now, the conversation perhaps should have ended there, except the guy asks a follow-up question. He says, and who is my neighbor? It's kind of like, well, there must be neighbors and non-neighbors, and I want to get some clarity, some definition on who I'm supposed to love, because maybe there's some other people I'm not supposed to love. The Greek word that's used there, it's like the English word neighbor. Neighbor means nigh dweller, somebody who lives near to you. And the Greek word also means, who am I supposed to get near to? Who's your neighbor? Who am I supposed to get near to? Who am I supposed to get close to? And the parable of the Good Samaritan is Jesus' response to that. So let me just kind of read the parable to you, and then we'll kind of dig into it a bit. I think I'm going to read the parable. There we go. Jesus replied, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. He went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back. Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among robbers? I always say it's kind of like asking, what color is George Washington's brown horse? It's like a question that should have an obvious answer. He said, the one who showed him mercy, and Jesus said to him, you go and do likewise. Okay? So, you know, thousands of sermons have no doubt been given on this parable, but we're looking at the subject of urgency and why you may or may not feel urgency, particularly about sharing the gospel. Now, all three of these guys, the priest, the Levite, and the Samaritan, see somebody in desperate need. They're not ignorant. It isn't like I didn't see it in my... They all saw him. The priest and the Levite don't respond with urgency, don't get involved, whereas the Samaritan sees, feels urgency, and gets involved. Everybody kind of with me so far? The key difference, if you're going to do a contrast, what's the difference, revolves around this word compassion. The Samaritan saw the person in desperate need, in urgent need, and felt urgency, felt compassion. And the word there, by the way, the word for compassion means intestines. That's the Greek word. He felt intestines for the guy. And yet, it's very similar to our English saying, have a gut-level reaction. He had a gut-level reaction to the suffering of another human being. He felt empathy. There's a difference between sympathy and empathy. Sympathy, you see somebody who's suffering and go, wow, just, that must be miserable to be like that. Empathy, you actually, in some measure, identify with what that must feel like to be that person. If you're compassionate, empathetic, you have a gut-level reaction. That's what's being pictured here. Okay? Now, here's my hypothesis. You may stick with me on this. You may say it's ridiculous. In order for us to feel urgency, we have to be aware of the seriousness of the need, and we have to be deeply compassionate. If we're aware of the need and we're compassionate, it will lead to urgency and involvement. If we are not sufficiently aware of the need, and if we are not sufficiently compassionate, we will not feel urgency. Which is to say, if we're not feeling urgency, we either lack awareness of the seriousness of the need, and or we lack the compassion to care for that person. How many of you, it's either a need problem or a compassion problem or both. How many of you still, the nice thing about Step Closer, by the way, which is where I usually am, is it's more interactive. And I'm sorry that with a large group, I'd love to get some interaction. But how many just, yeah, that sort of makes sense to me. If I'm not feeling urgency, either I don't see that people are in need, or quite frankly, I don't care that much. Okay? So I'm going to give you four scenarios. Okay, four kind of possibilities. And as we're going through them, you might say which one best fits you and me. Okay, and for me, I've been in all of these four scenarios or categories or ways of looking at things. You're going to get tired of looking at little dials, by the way, little gauges. So, but stick with me. Okay, scenario number one. This is the ideal scenario. I know many of you here fall in. You are like the Good Samaritan. This is kind of picture the inner gauges and dials on this guy's life. Okay, if we look inside of his head or whatever his little instrument panel is, he feels a high degree of need, or he's aware of a high degree of need. He has a high degree of compassion. When those two are combined, it leads him, it yields, it takes him to a place of high urgency, which then also produces involvement. If we're talking about the gospel, you see people as desperately in need of Jesus. You care very deeply about that, and that leads you to have an urgency and to be looking for opportunities to share the gospel, to make Christ known. Okay? So some of you may fall into this category. Like I say, this is the sort of the ideal. This is what we're, in some sense, praying that God will accomplish in our lives. But then we have scenario two. The priest and the Levite. Now, as I'm speculating about the inner dials, gauges on the dashboard of the priest and the Levite, they have a high awareness of the need. They see the guy. And yet, apparently, for whatever reason, they have a low sense of compassion. Oh, like, you know, Sapaka was talking about. This could be awkward to interact with a naked man beaten up by the side of the road. Right? Oh, I've never taken a CPR class. I don't know how to help the guy. Whatever the reason, their compassion is not sufficient to override other factors in their lives. And because they have low compassion, they end up with low urgency and they will pass by on the other side. Okay? Now for me, and I'm talking about my particular struggles over the years, why do I sometimes end up like the priest and the Levite? What is it that's warring against or overriding my compassion need, or the needle there? And I'm going to mention kind of three quick things. One is what I call compassion fatigue. Especially with the media, you turn on the television, you get all of the world's crises and needs essentially live. All the things that I should feel compassionate about. You know, here it is, flooding in Nebraska. Saying earlier, you know, Wes is from Alabama. They just had horrible tornadoes down there. We had all the fires up in Paradise. There are Syrian refugees. There are people starving in Yemen. There's just been a cyclone in Mozambique. We're inundated. And then you go to Facebook, and then all of a sudden, here's all these GoFundMe things that are coming at me. You know, it's easy if there's just one person beaten up by the road of life. But when it's one after another after another, Marshall McLuhan back in the 60s wrote a thing on the power of the media. He said, we've gotten to the point, he's back in the 60s, he said, we can watch the Vietnam War live while we're eating our TV dinner. We can see people who have been napalmed and eat our TV dinner. We know we should, oh, that must be terrible. And then we flip the channel and watch back in those days, Leave It to Beaver or some. We've apparently got to the point where we have compassion fatigue. We can't, we should, but we can't respond to the needs the way we might like to. And I find my own life with the recovery ministry, if it was just one alcoholic, one heroin addict, one meth addict, but when it's one after another, one homeless person after another, God protect me from compassion fatigue. And if I ever do get to the point where I do feel compassion fatigue, it's time for me to quit. If I no longer feel an urgency to get involved with the next person who's coming into my office who's strung out on meth or whatever it has to be. The second thing, it's kind of interwoven with compassion fatigue, is what's called the tyranny of the urgent. It's not just things for compassion. All of us face incredible demands, things that are claiming to be urgent. They're trying to grab our time and our energy. If you're at work, you're inundated with all these things at your work, then you come home and like, okay, I got to take the kids to soccer practice and dance lessons and taekwondo and music. And we can end up being just kind of overwhelmed with the tyranny of the urgent. That works against compassion. I know it does in my life a lot of times, where it just seems like I've got 42 pieces of cake on my plate, and now here's the 43rd piece, and I can't handle. You know, we're like the Mad Hatter, the White Rabbit. I'm late for a very important date. We're all multitasking. I say in the Bay Area, even when people are with you, they're not with you. They're thinking about nine other things, the tyranny of the urgent. And then to try to say, well, you should also be sharing about Jesus. How many of you mentioned the first service? How many of you ever saw the old movie Ben-Hur? Okay. Yeah, some of the younger people are looking like that. Okay. Old movie, the Jewish man gets sold into slavery, becomes a galley slave. And one of the scenes in the movie, they're on this galley and they're rowing. And there's a guy with a drum beat. Dum, 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 dum. And then, because they're in a battle, he starts going faster because they want to ram somebody. Dum, 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 dum. And all these galley slaves are just kind of going. I think the Silicon Valley is kind of like that. We're all at ramming speed. It's just that most of the time I'm not sure what we're trying to ram. But it leaves us too exhausted. I can't have time for compassion. I don't have time for sharing the gospel because of the tyranny of the urgent. And then beyond, compassion fatigue and the tyranny of the urgent, there is what I would simply call coldness. Jesus says in Matthew 24:12, because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall grow cold. Because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall grow cold. And the word for love there is agape. That is the love, the selfless, self-sacrificial love that should characterize us as Christians. You turn on the television, here's another mass murder. Here's another poor woman who's been sexually abused. Here's an incidence of racism. Here's injustice. And the tendency can be, I just want to withdraw from it all into a bubble of coldness where I can protect myself. And I think all of us need to be on guard against that. I give a talk, a short version, I don't mean to minimize any suffering that people are going through. But I think we live in a culture sometimes which we want to live in our own safe place. And we don't recognize that people are desperately hurting. We need to stop being so emotionally self-protective. Love is messy. It says about Jesus that he was a man of constant sorrows and acquainted with grief. We have to pray that God would protect us from becoming cold and getting into our own little bubble, self-protective bubble. We need to be following him into very messy situations, people beaten up physically or spiritually or emotionally. We need to be willing to enter into those as the Lord would lead us. Okay, so we got the priest and the Levite. Some of you may identify with that. Yeah, my compassion is pretty low. I see that people desperately need Jesus, but I don't feel much urgency about getting involved. Now, we're going to kind of step a little bit outside the parable because I'm just looking for ways compassion and need can combine. Here's the third scenario. I call it the oblivious Samaritan. Okay, the oblivious Samaritan. Now, the oblivious Samaritan really just doesn't see the degree of the need, even though he's a really compassionate person, like probably his brother. So he's just as compassionate as the good Samaritan, but, you know, picture him, he's riding down the road, and he's just really nearsighted. He's myopic. Great guy, on his little donkey or whatever, goes past, looks over, just sees a shape, and continues on. He doesn't really see that this person is in desperate need, and consequently, because there's no need to be met, he doesn't feel any urgency about meeting a need that isn't there. Now, how many of you, well, that's a really dumb example, Andy. I see it's a logical possibility, but I was a philosophy major, by the way, specialized in German philosophy, Kant, Hegel, Nietzsche, Heidegger, and they say that German philosophy is like an airport that is usually closed because of fog. Okay. So just thought I'd share that with you. So that's my background. Why does Andy talk the way he does? Okay, now, this is my own life. This is often the case with me. Yeah, I'm working with addicts, alcoholics, mental health, homeless, prisoners. I can see their need with my physical eyes. The problem is we live in one of the most wealthy places, or perhaps the wealthiest place in the history of the world. And to our physical senses, people often do not look like they're in desperate need. They're driving along in this beautiful car. They've got a lovely home in the hills. They've got their whatever, non-fat, soy, whatever it is. They're laughing. They're having a great time. They don't look like they're in desperate need. And to compound matters, they don't feel like they're in desperate need. Especially in desperate need of Jesus. And part of the problem can be that we get drawn into that. We can become, I believe, spiritually nearsighted and myopic. We just see what's before our eyes, people laughing. Somebody said, it's like passengers on a train. They're having a wonderful party, living it up, but the reality is the bridge is out ahead and they're all going to die. I understand that some futurists think that we're going to conquer death through artificial intelligence. No, it's out there. You can go read some of the futurists. But the Bible declares it's appointed to each person to die once and then the judgment. The reality is we are all going to die and we are all going to be accountable to God. The train is going to go over the cliff. And we need to get over our spiritual nearsightedness, our spiritual myopic vision, and ask God to give us eternal spectacles so we can see people in a larger eternal context. The larger context is this world is the crossroads of eternity. Every person you and I will ever meet is an eternal being. And the central question being decided in this world is where each of those beings will spend eternity, with God or separated from God. Jesus says there's a broad road that leads to destruction, a narrow road that leads to life. He says, what does it profit a man or woman to gain the entire world and lose his or her soul? That is the spiritual reality. People are in just as desperate need as the guy beaten up by the side of the road. It just doesn't appear that way to our natural eyesight. I know there are some who say, you know, well, we shouldn't mention hell in church, you know, because then nobody'd come to church if we meant we're in danger of becoming a hellfire and brimstone church. You know, Jonathan Edwards, you know, sinners in the hands of an angry God. I will tell you, this is Andy's perspective. I'm not speaking for anybody else around here. I think the real problem is that we have lost track of the fact that some people are on the road to heaven and others are perishing. Others are on the road to hell. And that diminished view of people's eternal destinies is part of what may be causing us to be spiritually nearsighted and myopic. It may be part of what is causing our sense of people's real need to be lower than it actually is. I'm going to give you a little quote up there. How many of you heard of Charles Spurgeon, one of the great 19th century preachers in England? And he was bemoaning the lack of revival. You know, why isn't there more revival? And here's what Charles Spurgeon had to say. Usually, how many, you got to shift into 19th century language here, okay, there's a little, it says, usually, when God intends greatly to bless a church, it will begin in this way. Two or three persons in it are distressed as to the low state of affairs and become troubled even to anguish. Perhaps they do not speak to one another or know of their common grief, but they begin to pray with flaming desire and untiring importunity. The passion to see the church revived rules them. They think of it when they go to rest. They dream of it on their bed. They muse on it in the streets. This one thing eats them up. They suffer great heaviness and continual sorrow of heart for perishing sinners. They travail in birth for soul. They sense the urgent need that's there. They sense the desperate need. Continual sorrow of heart for perishing sinners. I wish in my own life that that were more the case. And it may be true for some of you here. If you don't sense that people are desperately in need, pray that God might help you to get to this place and help me to get to that place. Okay, here's the fourth scenario. How many scenarios did I say there were?
Four.
Okay, I just wanted to see if somebody thought there might be 17 or whatever. Okay. This is the logical possibility. Scenario four, this is again does not appear in our text. I call it the oblivious priest and Levite. This is the worst of both worlds, which is low sense of need, low compassion, guess what? Low urgency. Right? Spiritually myopic, overrun by the compassion fatigue, the tyranny of the urgent, coldness. We go through the Bay Area in this condition, and we end up not feeling a tremendous urgency and consequently don't go out and share the gospel with people. Well, those are kind of the four scenarios. As I said, the Good Samaritan is the one that we're hoping for. But if you lack urgency, and I said in the first service, I'm not here to lay a guilt trip on anybody. I don't want anybody leaving church feeling guilty. But my hope is really that we would each do some soul searching, that if we're not feeling urgency about sharing the gospel, about making Jesus known, it traces either to a lack of awareness of the need and or to a lack of sufficient compassion, and that God might search us and change us. As David says in Psalm 139, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." If we're not feeling urgency, something is wrong. And we need to ask God both to reveal it and then for him to make whatever changes and lead us in the way everlasting. And it's a wonderful life to be like the Good Samaritan. In those moments when I've been like that, I wrestle with all the other scenarios too in my own life. You know, it's just amazing. I was sharing, I think again in the first service, New Year's Eve, Ed and Kathy Woodhall took my wife and I out to a very fancy restaurant. You know, I don't usually go to those kinds of places, but somebody invited us out. Everybody, all the waiters, they're all in coats and ties. And the one waiter, Bruno, this is New Year's Eve, and he says, "Oh, I hope you have a blessed New Year." Ron Ritchie used to say, anybody remember Ron? Just show up. You know, you just be kind of outside your own head, delivered from self-absorption. You're kind of in a bit more of the Good Samaritan place. You know, Bruno says, have a blessed new year. And I said, are you a Christian? And he says, how do you know? And I said, well, you know, it says in Romans, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, you will be saved. And we had this great little interchange. I wish I could say we got down and prayed together, but he actually followed us out of the restaurant when we left. And we had to leave because I was scheduled to speak at a homeless encampment on New Year's Eve. So I went straight from the fanciest restaurant that I've been in a while down to the homeless encampment where they had it was a very cold evening. Everybody's outside, propane tank with a little fire. And there's a guy, David, who comes up. I was talking, and then afterwards he came up and said, well, I just got evicted from my place in East Palo Alto. I don't know what to do. And I said, well, have you ever considered Jesus? And we had an absolutely wonderful conversation about the Lord. That is what I think God is calling us to. It's an exciting life. It isn't that suddenly, I've got to be more compassionate and I've got to have a better sense. This is a life. God's calling us into an exciting life, serving him. Somebody, I think, after the first service was saying, part of the problem is we don't think anybody here in the Bay Area would even accept Jesus. I think that's a lie from the devil. One point in the gospel, in Acts, Paul is in a city, and the Lord shows up and says, I have many people in this city. I believe God has many people, whether it's Bruno up at the restaurant or David out by the... God has many people that need to hear about Jesus in this area, and we need to be praying for God to bring us to a place of greater urgency. Now, let me close in prayer here. Lord, I do thank you for your word, and I pray that you'd be searching us by your spirit. If there are changes that need to be made, especially in the sense of becoming more aware of how people desperately need you, or if our compassion needs to be deeper, Lord, please change those things. Help us not to be standing at the crossroads of eternity, lukewarm and lacking urgency, but help us to hold out the words which, if accepted by faith, can change the eternal destinies of men and women. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.